esports field. We've spoken at other esports conferences, talked with other folks within the industry, and really figured out that a discussion about intellectual property and how that fits into the esports space is probably a good idea, especially seeing how the esports world is based primarily on intellectual property. So that was sort of the genesis of this discussion and what we want to talk with you about today. That being said, we want to make sure that this presentation is valuable and worthwhile to you. And we have a small enough group here that if anybody has any questions while we're going through this, just feel free to ask. We can make this as interactive as possible because we want to make sure that we cover the topics that you want to hear about. So that being said, what we're going to do is have a technology lawyer try to work the clicker. And all right, perfect. Yep. So the way we're going to start is we're going to have sort of an intellectual property 101 to make sure that we're all speaking the same language and we know what's what and what tools we're going to use in the esports world to protect our brands. The second part is we're going to take those concepts and apply it to esports, citing specific examples of how IP has been used in the esports world. And then the last part we're going to discuss briefly is considerations and monetization, right? How can you make your brand make money for you? What are the considerations you need to think of when you're writing those license agreements and going through the licensing process? So we'll go ahead and dive right in.
Yeah, so these are your basic building blocks of an IP portfolio. Start off with patents. There are two different kinds. There are utility patents that would cover things like devices. You know, like if you have a patent for a new mouse or keyboard or something like that. Design patents, they really cover the ornamental aspects, non-functional aspects of a device. And then finally, you have trade secret. This is a type of IP where if you have something that is of commercial value, it gives you a competitive advantage, you may want to keep that secret. You may not want to disclose because in the context of patents, in exchange for that disclosure, you know, publishing to the world, hey, I have an invention, you get exclusivity. With a trade secret, you keep that secret. You know, and the great thing about a trade secret is it continues as long as you keep it a secret. So a great example you always hear about is the formula for Coke. That's locked away in a safe somewhere down in Atlanta and is protected as long as they keep it secret.
And then we also have trade dress, which really protects the look and feel of a item so long as it identifies a source. And you're going to hear me say that a gajillion times today as it relates to trademarks, which is sort of our segue into the two most relevant pieces of IP for the esports space, and that's going to be trademark protection and your copyright protection, and that's going to be the focus of a large part of our discussion here. So trademarks, what is a trademark? A trademark is a word, phrase, or symbol, or the combination that identifies a source, and I can't say that enough because a trademark is not IP in the traditional sense, right? It's not something tangible that you can hold on to and keep other people away from in all aspects. It's only valuable to the extent it eliminates confusion as to a source of a good or service, right? It is a tool for consumers. So when a consumer sees that red label with the Coca-Cola written on top of it, they know that what's in that bottle or can is Coca-Cola, right? That's the purpose of trademark protection. It's also why Delta Airlines and Delta Faucets can both have the trademark Delta and still work together in the marketplace, right? Because no consumer is going to be confused that an airline is making a faucet. Trademarks also last for as long as they're able to identify a source. So if your trademark loses its ability to identify a source, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, then it's no longer protectable as a trademark. And not all trademarks are created equal, right? There's a spectrum of protection as it relates to trademarks. And it starts with the strongest as a fanciful mark. And basically what that is you just make up a word, right? Xerox, Kodak, right? Those are just words that were made up and used to identify the source of a good or service, right? The next step down is arbitrary, which is a word that already exists, but as applied is arbitrary, right? Apple computers. Apples don't have any relation to computers, but the goodwill and association was built at the Apple Computer Company. Suggestive, we start getting a little murkier, right? Suggestive sort of suggests what the mark is or what the good or service is, but doesn't go so far as to describe it. Descriptive is where you run into problems, okay? Because a descriptive mark describes exactly what it is that you're doing, the service you're providing, or the good, and can, in some instances, act as a protectable mark, but you got to put a little bit of legwork in, right? And this happens a lot in very entrepreneurial settings, very creative settings, where the creative minds have come up with either a new good that it's a totally new space, and they come up with a cool way to describe the product, and that's what they want to roll with, which is fine, except that consumers won't associate the source with that description of the product. That only happens over time, and in order to register that with the PTO, you actually have to develop evidence that consumers associate your company as the source of that good or service, which is a lot of work.
Yeah, so just to jump in here, especially like Chris said, when you're in the entrepreneurial context, you're starting a new company, there's always going to be the temptation to choose the descriptive mark, right? Because that signals to people what you do, right? If you're new to a space, the temptation is to go to the descriptive mark, but it is probably one of the weakest of all the trademarks.
And I will say too, and we've had a lot, when you're on this side, the fanciful side of the spectrum, registration, way less expensive. The further you go down, the more expensive it becomes, because now you got to develop evidence of association with your good or service. Now, generic is never protectable. It's like trying to trademark the if you're the Ohio State University. USPTO just said, doesn't work, right? You can't do that, okay? There's another form of generic that's sort of the opposite, where you hit a home run and your mark becomes a verb. Right? It becomes what the thing is. Like, Google this for me, right? They still have protection, but they got to work on it, because that can be a problem, right? Xerox this for me. Xerox has had a problem with that in the past. And the fine lawyers at Velcro put a wonderful song together to describe this, which we've got here for you. If I can get it to play.
Yeah. We hope you find it funny. For us IP nerds, it is pretty funny.
We promise we're tech lawyers.
Yeah.
Second screen. Got it. Right. It's worth it, trust me.
Thank you.
We're a company that's so successful. Everywhere you go, you see the scratchy, hairy fastener, and you say,
hey, that's Velcro!
But even though we invented this stuff, my patent lasts 40 years ago. Now no matter who else makes it, you still wanna call it Velcro. You think it's awesome for us, we're famous, but we're lawyers and it's causing us grief. But there are trademark laws being broken, it's all here in this short legal brief. And we know that this is confusing, because Velcro branded who we are.
What if you call all Velcro?
We know this seems ridiculous. This is a first world situation. And we made half of $1 billion last year.
Oh, when the third boom on a vacation.
And we're asking you not to say a name. We took 60 plus years to build. But if you keep calling these Velcro shoes, our trademark will get you. Yeah.
We aren't just doing this for us. We're doing it for all the successful brands that got so popular, people started using the brand names the wrong way. So please, remember.
If you need something to clean up your socks, do it with bleach and not with f***. If you have blood from a poop on your mate, this is a fetish and not a f***. If you're
exercising with someone you're dating. If your life's dating enough, I know that bleep stuff is more fun to say, but if you keep doing it, our dream must go away.
I mean, really, it's really a problem that only a lawyer could create, right? To be so successful as a business that you lose the very right you were trying to build up. So just a couple more points on trademarks before we move on to copyrights. So far as infringement is concerned, in order to continue to have your trademark identify you as a source of a good or service, you got to make sure that there's nobody out there either using your mark or using a confusingly similar imitation of your mark, right? So a couple things that will come up. Sometimes someone will try to register a mark that's a little too close or is the same thing. You can stop them at the USPTO if someone's using it in the marketplace. You can send cease and desist letters. You can sue them in federal court. One thing that I didn't list up there that I'm kind of kicking myself at, I should have, a registration is generally a huge asset in getting websites that host third-party content to take down infringing uses. So if somebody is using your mark through a Reddit or WordPress or Google or something like that, and you look at their terms on the website, generally they'll have, you know, don't infringe anybody's IP, and they'll have a methodology for submitting an IP claim. But they're not in the business of making the call on infringement, right? So they're going to want to see that registration, and that's where it becomes really important. So that's a quick overview of trademarks. I think we're going to go into copyright now.
Yeah, we'll just jump into copyright. So you mentioned copyright is about protecting artistic works, right? So the things that come to mind are, you know, movies, books, music, things like that. So you have to have a work of authorship. It has to be original. Yeah, it has to involve some amount of creativity. And what that means is you can't get a copyright to a recipe or instructions on how to build something. There has to be some creative element involved. And lastly, it has to be fixed in a tangible medium. So you have to, it can't just be an idea in your head. It has to be reduced to a writing or a recording or otherwise captured. So how do you get a copyright? Well, the good news is you get a copyright upon creation, basically, as soon as you reduce it to that tangible medium. There's no real requirement to provide notice to others, but it is recommended. There's also no requirement that you register it with the Copyright Office, but it is highly recommended, and I'll go into some of that a little bit later. And the expression of your work is copyrightable. Right, so you can't get a copyright on a procedure or a process or an idea or a method. And that's why it's important to reduce it to a tangible form. So when you hear a lot of folks talk about copyright, we use copyright in the singular, but it is really a bundle of rights. So the right to reproduce a work or make copies of it, make derivative works, which is to either build on that original work or make modifications, such as adaptations, things of that nature. You have the right to distribute copies to the public or perform your work publicly or display your work publicly. And also, you know, in the case of a sound recording, you have the right to transmit that in audio form. So a copyright owner, you know, let me go back here. For all these rights, a copyright owner has the ability to transfer or license these rights individually. So you may have a license just to the right to reproduce the work or make copies, or the copyright owner can also license or transfer the entire bundle of rights together. So how long does a copyright last? So for individuals, it's to the end of the creator's life plus 70 years. If a group of individuals have created a work, it's the last living person plus 70 years. And we have, you know, a little bit different regime for works made for hire, and I'll go into that a little bit later. So there is the general rule that the creator of a copyright owns the copyright, but you can contract around that. You see that most often in employment contexts. So if you're an employee, you're creating things in the scope of your work at your job, typically your employment contract will cover that and transfer that any of those copyrights that are created to your employer. Same thing for an independent contractor. There are contractual arrangements that provide for the transfer of those copyrights to the person or business that commissioned the work. So it's important to know exactly what your rights are, what the contracts that you're signing say, because you may think that you own something that you really don't, depending on the situation. So like I mentioned, you're not really required to register a copyright, but it's highly recommended, and for a number of reasons. First and foremost, it's so easy, it's almost a no-brainer. Like, why wouldn't you do it? It's pretty cheap. It's inexpensive.
You don't have to talk to one of us to do it.
Yeah, you can do it yourself. It's a fairly, fairly simple process. It involves filling out a form, paying a fee, and in most cases, depositing the thing that you wish to have copyrighted with the copyright office. But that registration gives you a lot of benefits. The first one is in the enforcement context, right? If you think somebody's infringing on your copyright, if you have a registration, you can walk into federal court and file an action for copyright infringement. You also have the ability to get statutory damages. Without a registration, you're going to be limited to actual damages, which is oftentimes hard to prove because you have to show that, well, how was I damaged economically because of this other person's infringement of my copyright? Or, you know, how much did that other that infringer profit from my copyrights? It's a lot easier to prove damages in the statutory, to establish damages in the statutory damages context. If you prevail in litigation, you can also get attorney's fees and have those covered as well.
That's going to be crucial too, because in a lot of litigation contexts, the other side knows that in order to bring a case, you're going to have to spend money, they're going to have to spend money. A lot of times it's a wash. A prevailing party, part of that statute where you get attorney's fees, if you're the prevailing party, the other side's going to know, oh man, they got us and we're going to have to pay their attorney's fees too. So that's huge when you're trying to negotiate with someone to stop an infringement.
Yeah. And the other aspect is the presumption of copyright validity, right? Because once you have that registration, there's a presumption that you own the copyright, that you know you created that work on a certain date. These things are oftentimes hard to prove if you don't have that registration. You know, because let's say you, I think I have a question back there.
And there's no damage, it's just you're using, and I'll be specific, it was about a politician.
Right.
We use the political picture
right.
for 4 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk about video game violence.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously scour the internet.
Yep.
And so there's really no damage. We didn't make money. It's going to cost us money to produce that.
But there is, though, right? It's the statutory damages,
right.
And that's... They wrote the statute such a way because it's hard to prove damages in that instance. They include the statutory damages so you get something out of it if you're the artist, if you're the person who took the picture, because otherwise they're not going to get
it. Isn't it YouTube? No,
because YouTube allows that content to come in from somebody else. So there's another statute called the Digital Millennial Copyright Act, right? And if the author of that image were to send a takedown notice to YouTube,
right,
and say, this is my copyright, you have to take it down, YouTube will take it down. If it doesn't, it loses its immunity under the Communications Decency Act, which is an entire thing that we could get into. It's like another CLE, but just know that is something YouTube will never do because they need that immunity in order to do what they do, right? In order to have third-party content up on their site. So if they take it down in response to the cease and desist, they're immune, they'll keep it down unless the person who used it can come back to YouTube and say, no, I actually have a right to use this, and then, you know, there's a little back and forth. YouTube could put it back up, but Generally speaking, it's going to be on YouTube to take it down if challenged.
So the owner of the photograph finds out that YouTube has it posted. Other people grabbed it off of YouTube. YouTube isn't the violation of the copyright. It's the people that pulled it off. You don't know. Wait, it doesn't have a circle C on it or anything on it.
It doesn't have to.
Doesn't have to.
No. They can if they can show that they were the creator, that they own the copyright, and not necessarily they're the creator, but that they own the copyright, then they can come after any infringer. It's a strict liability offense. So
yeah.
We run into that issue frequently. We actually did a case not too long ago where some pictures from the earthquake in Haiti were used off of Twitter. And the person who took the pictures came after Getty Images for that reason, because they were using them.
Yeah, and it really kind of flows back to whoever posted the video. There was a case where a mother posted a video of her toddler dancing to Prince's "Let's Go Crazy."
Yeah,
that was a huge case, right?
But the liability doesn't fit with YouTube. It's whoever posted it on YouTube.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
But does YouTube, will YouTube give up that information to say who posted?
They may.
Really?
They may. It depends what their terms are, and if you sue, I mean, you could sue a John Doe, so you don't know who actually posted it, then subpoena YouTube, and YouTube will absolutely give the name then. So.
And do you consider, I know this will get into the whole thing, but is that considered like a fair use argument in terms of...
It depends on the use. It depends on the use, and that gets into a very factual analysis of whether or not it's fair use. For news reporting, it may not be, because that may be the photographer's livelihood. They may be out there documenting news and selling it to news agencies, so that wouldn't be a fair use necessarily.
Well, the joke was to use the photograph and say, wow, what a bad hairdo, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To comment on it, yeah.
Yeah. Comment on
yeah.
it.
Yeah, right. And that could fall into the square a fair use.
Right.
So in terms of a copyright infringement action, in evaluating a claim, the first thing, you have to own the copyright to be able to bring an action. You have to show that they've infringed one of those rights I spoke about earlier, the right to distribute or copy or display. And then you have to show that there has been some form of copying, or it's substantially similar to the copyrighted work. And as we've already discussed, there are some defenses to copyright infringement, such as fair use or independent creation. Or if you have a license, obviously that's a great defense to copyright infringement.
Just one thing I want to point out there, and a lot of times in esports, the focus of the copyright is in the publisher, right? The publisher creates the game, they're the licensor of the copyright. But copyright applies to everything that the teams and the influencers and players are doing in terms of content creation, right? So blogs, all of that stuff that they're recording. Copyright is created in those once it's fixed in a tangible form of medium. And I'm glad you asked that question, because if somebody were to start ripping off blogs and posting them elsewhere without permission, cease and desist under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is a very powerful tool that you're able to use for a very inexpensive piece of intellectual property.
Explain this cease and desist. The cease and desist, does a copyright holder, can they just sue without giving a cease and desist? Or is there a legal amount of time where they give you a 24 hours to take it down?
You could, but under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, there's various specific steps and things that you have to include in the cease and desist.
Can you just sue without a cease and desist?
Yeah, you could.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how does this IP relate to the esports world? Well, what we're really going to go into is talking about copyrights, which is the main intellectual property owned by the publishers, and trademarks, brands, slogans, and product names. These typically are the IP that's used by individuals, teams, basically everyone else in the esports world. So copyrights in esports. Games are eligible for copyrights for two reasons. One, there's a copyright in the audiovisual work, the actual how the game, what you see on the screen. And there's also a copyright in the underlying code. So the copyright in the game, gives the creators of that work a lot of kind of power over how that copyright is exploited. The publisher gets to kind of decide who gets to compete in some of these games, who organizes the competitions, how the competitions are organized. So there's a lot of power that's held by the creators of games because of their ownership of these copyrights. So just like in traditional sports, there's no copyright in the actual performance of them, right? Because you really can't recreate any performance. It's interactive, so that it's not reduced to a tangible medium. But there is a copyright in the recording of a performance, and those copyrights are typically owned by the tournament organizers or in some instances the publishers themselves. However, there may be some protection for folks who are doing casting, if they are doing commenting on games, that there are copyrights that are created independent of the publishers there.
All right, so with regards to trademarks in esports, you see it, with everyone. I mean, even the publishers have very strong brands that they trademark and have developed, but it becomes especially important for teams, players, because of endorsements. And when you're going to enter an endorsement agreement, you really have to have registered IP, and the trademark being a big part of that. What can you register? Things like game tags, names, logos, jerseys, all of those things can be trademarked. And you'll see that here are some examples where we have each of these team names have been registered. Envy, Liquid, Evil Geniuses. The gamer tag Fatality has been registered with the USPTO. And so, I mean, you may be thinking, all right, great, so I registered this with the USPTO and I'm done. Like, there's really not a whole lot to it. Ninja is a great example of how some very careful thought and planning went into what was actually registered at the PTO, because you'll see that he's registered his logo, the stylized text of the word ninja, but it's really important to know what categories he's in. And I didn't put this up here for you to actually be able to read it, although I guess you kind of can, but just look at the breadth of services, right? This kind of goes back to the Delta Airlines, Delta Faucets. This is what Ninja has carved out for himself in terms of what his brand is going to cover. And it has what you would expect, right? Audio and video recordings featuring video game playing, right? But there's other things covered as well that you may not. Bedding, clothing, sporting articles, online retail store services, right? These are things that are either a core part of his business or that where he thinks his business is going to go, and he started creating protection surrounding that.
Yeah. Question here.
So, does he pay a fee for each of those, or is it?
Yes, you have to pay a registration fee for each class that you want to register.
But you only really want to cover the stuff you can actually.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's where you have to sit down as a business and say, what are my core competencies? What do I have to protect now? And then think, all right, well, where am I going to go in the future? And then you can start to protect those. Even if you're not there, there's actually a methodology at the trademark office to sort of call dibs on a space, right? You can file an intent to use application. So if you're not quite using the mark in a certain way yet, but you know you're going to, go ahead and file, get that protection, and then prove your use to the USPTO later, because really, trademarks only protect use. So you have to make that showing at registration, whether you're using it now or whether you're going to use it near time in the future.
So if you don't carve it out, let's say that you thought you were going to do audio recordings and backpacks, but you didn't know necessarily if you were going to do bedding.
Right.
And somebody just comes along and makes bedding with your logo on it.
So that could be a problem. When you say with your logo on it, if it's close enough to some of the other categories, you may have a good infringement case. it may be a problem with registration, but in terms of likelihood of confusion with consumers, there's a very narrow area of case law that says if it's an industry that is foreseeable that the company would have gone into, there may be some protections there, but the problem, as you described, may actually be the case.
Yeah,
somebody could come in and use it in that regard.
Yeah, the natural area of expansion.
Right, right.
So if you're, you know, TGI Fridays or something, and you're like, well, I have restaurants, but I may extend my business into doing frozen dinners in the grocery store, for example. So.
But TGI Fridays may also decide to print bed sheets.
Right.
If they didn't carve that out, I could print TGI Friday bed sheets.
Well, you couldn't, because if you're using the, well, it depends if you're using their logo. I mean, that would be an infringement for sure.
Right. And also, in that specific example, TGI Fridays is going to be a famous mark. So because of TGI Fridays' fame, you'd also have a claim for dilution of their mark, right? Yeah. Okay, so skipping ahead briefly, because I want to make sure that we get to the licensing portion of this too. Esports is a very international phenomenon, right? It is a global market. Everything we've talked about thus far today applies to the United States. It has nothing to do with overseas, right? So if you want to protect your IP overseas, you're going to have to work with attorneys in other countries to file that. And it's important because while you have to show use in the United States to file a trademark, you don't in other countries. And I've seen this in other industries where a manufacturer will cut a deal with a Chinese manufacturer to make a certain product, relationship goes sideways, right? Contracts canceled, the manufacturer in China runs and registers the trademark in China. Now they can legally make the product in China, ship it out. They may have some trouble getting it to the US, but they won't have any trouble getting it anywhere else, right? So it's very, very important to, when you're sitting down developing your trademark strategy, to also consider registering IP in other countries. Okay, so utilizing your IP. Now that you've secured all this stuff, what are you going to do with it, right? Well, of course, you want to make some money with it. You want to exploit the IP. And this is where very, very clear contracts are a necessity. And these are just six things that are really key aspects of any agreement that you'll want to consider. Exclusivity and what rights are being licensed are sort of overlapping, but you'll have to determine, am I going to enter in this agreement with this company or with this influencer to exclusively market this product? Am I going to open it up to others, and what's the effect of that?
Yeah, and exclusivity and scope is important, you know, particularly in endorsements, right? So let's say you have a deal to endorse a certain type of keyboard, right? And you're casting, you know, can you have some other manufacturer's mouse in that cast, or the chair that you're sitting on? Maybe there's some sort of provision in your agreement that would prohibit you from using another manufacturer's chair. So you really need to pay close attention to the terms of these agreements, and certainly with the scope and exclusivity provisions.
All right. Also, in a lot of these agreements, there's a sort of partnership to create content, right? There's a brand. They want an influencer to create content across various social media channels. Who owns the content that's created, right? That should be spelled out in the agreement, because a lot of times it's not the creator. So it's going to go to the brand that hired them as a work made for hire, unless it's otherwise specified in the contract. So that should absolutely be in the contract. Geographic scope. Is this limited to the United States? Are we licensing rights overseas? Do you even have the licensing ability for rights overseas? Have you secured those rights? Geographic in the sense of, is this an online sponsorship? Is it online in television? All of this needs to be thought through and spelled out in the agreement, yeah. Right?
And who will be responsible for policing all those rights,
right,
over time?
Right. In terms of duration, this is critical in an industry that's moving so quickly. The head of media from Hershey's was on a panel yesterday and said that he, as a matter of practice, won't sign an agreement longer than a year, because he doesn't want Hershey's attached to an IP that's no longer relevant, right? So that needs to be thought through as well. Calvin mentioned policing. That kind of comes up under audit rights. You're going to want certain things in the contract that require the licensee to really prove that they're doing what they say they're going to do, right? If they're going for so many impressions or so many posts or whatever the case may be in the license, the licensor is going to want audit rights to be able to make sure that that actually happened. And then moral clauses have been getting more and more attention lately. You've seen it in examples like Michael Phelps getting dropped from Kellogg's for using marijuana. Tiger Woods lost a number of sponsors with his domestic troubles. This is going to be crucial in esports endorsement agreements the biggest reason I can think of right now is just trolling, right? Brands aren't going to want to be associated with certain online conduct. And you're really going to want to spell out in a morals clause what sort of conduct the brand won't tolerate that gives the brand an out from that agreement. So I know we're kind of bumping up against time here, and this is probably a good place to take questions. Does anybody have any questions?
If we contact you, could we get a copy of your slide deck?
I believe so. Yeah, absolutely.
Reach out.
Sure. We will give our copyright over.
Don't post it anymore. Right, exactly.
On YouTube.
Well, since you want to be kind of funny, I'll be funny back too. Your last name is Crook.
And a lawyer, right?
And you're a lawyer. All
right, so get this. Not only is it a crook and a lawyer, I come from a family of cops too. So get that way. Thank you, everybody, for attending. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
A great rest of the show.
You guys license here in another state?